Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of June 4th, 2019. As we approach the fourth anniversary of the Mother Emanuel Amy Church massacre that left 9 parishioners dead and a state reeling, we speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jennifer Barry Hawes of the Post and Courier about her new book, Grace Will Lead Us Home, The Charleston Massacre and the Heart-Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness. Hawes chronicles the tragedy and the aftermath through pointed, detailed accounts that tells a story that must never be forgotten. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with reporters who wrote the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all 4 sections instead of wondering if they really needed to make another season of Big Little Lies. Is it just for Meryl Streep? I'm still going to watch. Or while you're literally melting outside. But, you know, the Lead is also great by the pool or beach, so just take us along with you. We'll even come. Just send us an invite. And now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. And just an FYI, we're rolling campaign trail into this quorum call so we can have more time for our main discussion. Number one, Democrat Jamie Harrison is officially challenging Republican Senator Lindsey Graham for his U.S. Senate seat. Harrison, the former state Democratic Party chairman, made it official last Wednesday in an online video following his appearance on The Rachel Maddow Show the evening before. Harrison is the second Democrat to enter the race, but is by far the most prominent one. Gloria Bramall Tinubu is also running. Harrison serves as a top executive with the Democratic National Committee, and he's received endorsements from big 2020 candidates, including tweets from former Vice President Joe Biden and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, as well as several celebrities. He announced a $270,000 haul in the first 24 hours of his campaign launch. Number two, a Telopinion research poll of 600 South Carolina Democratic primary voters found former Vice President Joe Biden as the clear frontrunner. A critical finding of the poll is Biden's 84% net favorability among black voters. While both Senators Kamala Harris and Cory Booker have high name ID, there remains large segments of uninformed opinion amongst all key demographics. When compared to Biden, both candidates lack the intensity behind their positives that Biden enjoys with African Americans. The poll asked, "Who would you like to see win the Democratic nomination?" 37% said Biden, 32% said they're unsure, which is really not surprising. 10% said Senator Bernie Sanders, 8% said Senator Elizabeth Warren, 7% Harris, 3% Mayor Pete Buttigieg, and 2% Booker. Other candidates didn't rank. Now, this poll was conducted between May 22nd and the 24th, with a margin of error of plus or minus 4%. Number three, following up on our coverage of the state budget, Governor Henry McMaster unveiled his budget vetoes last week. The Associated Press reports that the governor vetoed 28 items from the budget worth more than $40 million, which is really not that much considering the budget's $9 billion. One prominent veto rejected $11 million for a case management system at the Judicial Department. House Speaker Jay Lucas said previously that McMaster's budget vetoes would be so inconsequential that lawmakers could take them up when they return in January. Number four, the state newspaper reports that South Carolina taxpayers are paying nearly $300 million a year for the state's gun violence, according to a report from the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. The Giffords Law Center determined that almost $300 million price tag was because of law enforcement efforts that are financed by public dollars, and 85% of gunshot victims nationally are uninsured or on publicly funded health plans. The report also found that gun deaths increased 25% across the state from 2014 to 2017. South Carolina has the 12th highest death rate in the country due to gun violence. And now for our Florida Man News segment. Every week, we give you just a headline, a taste of the most captivating Florida Man news. This week, snake slithers out of toilet, bites Florida Man. I mean, that's everyone's worst fear. Can we admit that? We've all been there. And just like Lindsay Lohan's relationship with Paris Hilton, we've buried the lead. From the roots of the Mother Emanuel AME Church shooting, to the removal of the Confederate battle flag at the State House, to the death penalty trial for the assailant who killed 9 black parishioners in Charleston in hopes of starting a race war, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jennifer Barry Haas takes us through that horrendous day, the survivor's painful first year, and the trial that sentenced the white supremacist to death for the murder of Cynthia Hurd, Susie Jackson, Ethel Lance, DePayne Middleton Doctor, Clemente Pinckney, Tawanza Sanders, Daniel Simmons Sr., Sharonda Singleton, and Myra Thompson. It's a story told through the family's pain and how they created the narrative of grace and forgiveness. But the journey was far from easy and exposed many fractures in relationships along the way. The Post and Courier's Jennifer Barry Haas joins me from Charleston to discuss her new book, Grace Will Lead Us Home, The Charleston Massacre and the Hard, Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness. It's an unflinching, detailed portrait of one of the worst tragedies to affect South Carolina. Jennifer, welcome to the South Carolina Lead.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So, Jennifer, just reading the dedication page to your book, it's dedicated for the 9 who died on June 17th, 2015. That stopped me in my tracks. I paused. I took a deep breath, got my mind right, and kept going. But you realize that this is a heavy but necessary book to read. And I'm guessing that was kind of your intention in writing this book.
Exactly. I wanted to bring a journalistic eye to what happened and paint for people a more accurate picture of what happened after the shooting. You know, most people remember the shooting because Dylan Roof's bond hearing a day after he was arrested. The family members spoke words of forgiveness and themes of Christian grace and love, and it was very beautiful and really inspired the nation. And that narrative came to gel around the tragedy. And yet what I saw on the ground was much more complicated. I wanted to tell a story that was more accurate to what was happening here and to the painful journeys that they were sent on.
And the accounts are raw and, like we said, unflinching. Early on in the book, it reads like a breaking news story, not breathless or short, but one in which the reporter has all the horrific details of the crime down to the loved one's final moments or to a husband's reaction to the news a world away. It's pointed, powerful, and important storytelling, Jennifer. And we'll never really know the pain that those families went through. But I feel like your goal is to bring us to the places of incredible sympathy with your storytelling, especially early on in that book and throughout it.
Exactly. I wanted for people to really know the people who are most directly affected as real human beings who had great difficulty. You know, they're complicated. They all responded to trauma differently. One thing that the forgiveness narrative did, I think, was paint them as sort of a homogenous group, which in many ways they were, most of them being devoted Christians, for example. But as human beings, they were complicated. They had divisions within their families that they had to deal with. They had to grapple with tremendous loss, many of them under an intense media spotlight, particularly that first year, and then during the trial. I wanted for people to understand that they were complex and that their reactions were normal, and that's the kind of thing we're seeing in communities all around the country who are dealing with these mass shootings, that the fallout is tremendous. It's not limited to one storyline. And I wanted for people to understand the horror of that night, because I think it's very difficult to understand the reactions if you don't understand the depths of what they lost and the trauma that the survivors were left to deal with.
And some of the details you have, I mean, those are, I'm guessing, gathered from police reports, but also from these firsthand accounts from the survivors who were in that room at Emanuel.
Right, exactly. So in much of the book is that way, where I would, obviously, for things I was present at, that's easy to report on. But there were moments, for instance, the families, church members, and the survivors all gathered at the embassy suites here in Charleston the night of the shooting right afterward. And I knew I wanted to capture what it was like in that hotel, because I just could not fathom the stress and anger and fear, the questions that were circulating among the people gathered. And so I tried to interview as many of them as I could when I created that scene, because to me it was critical to understand moving forward, but also I just wasn't there. And so one thing that I found most interesting was that people will remember things a little bit differently. Some people remembered the coroner coming into that room full of people. There were hundreds of them gathered in a ballroom and announcing, you know, the family of Tawanza Sanders, the family of Clemente Pinckney, the family of Myra Thompson, and then the families would leave the room to hear the news of their loved one's death. Other people remember the coroner going around to tables of families and summoning them. So it's those little details. To me, it was interesting to see how people remembered them differently. But then as a journalist, you know, you're trying to write a story that's as accurate as possible. And so it required a lot of work to reconstruct those scenes and to make them as accurate as I could possibly make them to the actual events.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and those details, I mean, they're so enlightening and they're so incredible that you have so many. I mean, even down to, like, I can't remember who it was, but that they were having an eye twitch and they thought something was going to happen, and it was just moments before they found out that their loved one was killed at Emmanuel. It's just all these details, and even going forward, and I'm wondering, you know, you put so much work into this and there's so many emotions. How difficult was it for you to work on this book? You know, for years you were on this book, and what were your moments of anguish and maybe doubt, and how did you get through those moments?
You know, it was interesting because it's not always the way that I thought. I thought I would be overwhelmed with sadness. For instance, talking with Felicia Sanders and Polly Shepherd, the survivors, and I was, but I really felt with them more just, you know, honored to share that story with them and that they would entrust me with it. And where it hit me more was when I would be in my normal life, you know, with my own children, and then all of a sudden have thoughts that, you know, oh my goodness, something's going to happen to my child. My children went to school right across the street from Emmanuel, so I would drive by the church every day. When I would leave my son there, I would sometimes just be kind of overwhelmed with worry that something would happen to him in the school or the other children there, because I had driven by Emmanuel hundreds of times before and never would have thought about it the way I obviously did after the shooting. And that could happen anywhere, and it is happening everywhere. It's happening in schools and houses of worship and, gosh, movie theaters and all kinds of places. And so I think, for me anyway, it was more out of the blue moments like that where I would be dropping my son off and leaving him, be suddenly very fearful for his safety, but not want to communicate that to him so that he's not taking that to school with them.
Mm-hmm. There's another moment in this book where the families, you know, they forgive Dylan Roof at that bond hearing, like you previously mentioned. It's a pivotal act in this tragedy. And shortly after there, you cut in the book to President Barack Obama on Marine One. And he's thinking about his response to the shooting and gun violence. And he's going to take one approach to this. But then they find out about this forgiveness narrative or this forgiveness theme coming out of Charleston with these families standing up and through tears forgiving this person that took their loved ones away from them. Was that easy for these families to do? I mean, they, like you said earlier, it wasn't a homogeneous moment there. I mean, it was there, but throughout the book, you do see some fractures within the families themselves about whether they should have forgiven Dylan Roof.
No, and almost all of them described for me, I talked to the four people who spoke at that bond hearing, and they all described how they didn't go there expecting to speak. So in the case of Nadine Collier, she was the first woman who spoke. Nadine is a very spunky, outspoken, funny lady. And she described for me how she hadn't planned to speak, but she felt her mother's spirit come into her and really make her get up and speak those words. And she could feel her mother saying, I'll say it in nicer terms, but, you know, don't show you're behind. Go up there and say this. And so she was very open with the fact that that came from her mom and not from her. That might not have been what she said had she been, you know, just purely speaking on her own behalf. They all describe that feeling. Anthony Thompson described telling his children he was not going to speak, and neither were they. He had been a probation and parole officer, and so he knew how bond hearings worked, and he didn't want them to get emotional any more than they already were. And so he told them he wasn't going to speak, and neither were they, and yet he felt called by God to get up there and speak those words. And so they all had very similar stories. Felicia Sanders spoke because she was one of the survivors, because she wanted to keep the calm in Charleston. She didn't want somebody else to lose a son as she had, or a family member as she had. So they all talked about feeling compelled really just in that moment, which I thought was really interesting and honest, instead of saying, oh, of course, that's how I would react. I'm a good Christian and that's what I believe. They all talked about being very human, and their responses were often led by their feeling that God was leading them or their loved one.
And speaking of President Obama, what prompted you to include his entire eulogy to Reverend Clementa Pinckney at the end of the book?
Well, part of it was because I thought it just encapsulated a lot of the themes of the book. And another reason was because one of the family members, J.A. Moore, who's now in the State House, he lost his sister in the shooting. And he told me once that that eulogy was for his generation. He's a younger man in his 30s. And he was telling me that that speech was for his generation, a lot like Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech for the older generation of African Americans who felt that it gave hope to what seemed like a hopeless situation. And so I felt that it just felt right. It felt like we needed to include that for those reasons, and the reasons that that eulogy will be really a defining moment in this whole story.
And when we talk about history, You know, there are so many moments in this book of intensity, and I don't want to dissuade people not to read it because of that, because that's so important to the story. But there's intense moments, and then you kind of come up for air and you intersperse informative historical details. You know, one of them being the John C. Calhoun statue in Marion Square, and you said how it appeared to scowl at the survivors below as they were moved to the embassy suites, which was originally built as an arsenal to protect the city's whites in fear of future slave uprisings after Denmark Vesey, a freed slave who plotted a revolt in 1822. And that was years after he helped found Mother Emanuel Church. So what was your reasoning to provide such great historical detail throughout your book?
I wanted the city to be in itself a character, because everywhere you go in Charleston, there's a story, I feel like. There's a story often that we don't know or has been shoved into some corner of history and not acknowledged. And as I followed the survivor's path that night, I realized that was so important to this story and understanding, obviously, why Dylann Roof came here. He stated he came to Charleston because of its history. And I felt like we needed to put it into that context, that this is a place where plantations are tourist stops and people have weddings there. Yet, you know, if you go to Germany and you look at their history, you would never have a wedding in a concentration camp. That would be the most horrific thing you could imagine. Mm-hmm. And yet we treat the history here so differently. So I wanted to make sure that that was included here, that we understood the historic foundations of racism and the white supremacist views that Roof held, but also how it affected the survivors and others as they were moving through this journey. As you said, you know, they were at a hotel that had been the arsenal built to defend the city from slave uprisings. To me, that was really, really interesting.
But looking at this all-encompassing read, it's not only a look into the lives of the victims' families, but also that of Governor Nikki Haley, who steered South Carolina through that difficult time, and the Walter Scott shooting, which was just 2 months prior. You know, you really humanize Haley, who is an Indian American with her own story of racial discrimination and the fight she led to remove the Confederate battle flag from the Statehouse grounds. I wonder, you know, if outsiders looking in at those weeks in the summer of 2015 and think, you know, of the thousands of folks that came together on the Ravenel Bridge, the flag coming down, Obama coming to town, that maybe they thought maybe the state is healed, but and that undercurrent, that narrative of forgiveness really got solidified. But is that truly the case? I mean, I know a lot of things happen on the surface, but when we look at where we are since then, have we moved forward in a sense, or was it just a lot of symbolic gestures?
Well, I think we've moved forward in some ways, undoubtedly. You know, there's been a number of efforts here in Charleston to try to bridge racial divides and have conversations about race. But I think what we're missing is the deeper changes that are necessary. I know the family members were disappointed that there weren't more comprehensive policy changes, for instance, that might help alleviate the racial disparities in South Carolina, or that might help better protect African Americans from people who would want to harm them because of their race. I think that piece has been a disappointment. You know, I included a University of South Carolina survey that was done, as I recall it, the first anniversary, and it asked the question of whether people thought race relations had improved or not as a result of the Walter Scott shooting and the Emanuel shooting. And white people here were much more likely to say they thought race relations had improved, where black residents were much more likely to say they had gotten worse. And I thought that that was fascinating because the perception was so different. I think that, well, I can say I wrote a story for the newspaper about that survey, and I received a number of angry emails from readers, mm-hmm. white readers, who felt that, you know, this was just stirring the pot, and why couldn't people just be happy? There had been all these shows of unity. But I think they were missing the point, which was that many black residents felt differently. Where is that disconnect happening? And that disconnect, I think, continues. But that said, there's been a number of positive changes here. For instance, it's just they tend to be smaller and they tend to be more personal kinds of changes. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, Mount Zion AME is Emanuel's daughter church here. And its pastor, Kylon Middleton, was a good friend of Clemente Pinckney's and is very close with Jennifer Pinckney. And Kylon and his church created this book study with members of Grace Episcopal Church, which is right next door and is an historic white church in town. And this book study will draw 6,100 people every Tuesday to discuss books that deal with race and essays. And they'll talk about them in this diverse mix of people. And I think those kinds of things, when we can have honest conversations across racial lines, are making important improvements. But systemically, I think that, you know, the conversation about white supremacy and white nationalism nationally is certainly continuing here in South Carolina. I mean, we continue to grapple with that history and I think really struggle to figure out how to heal it.
And just kind of want to jump back in and look at some other parts of the book. You know, you brought us into these lives of these survivors and the victims' families. You know, you illuminated Ethel Lance's family division and issues within the church that people like survivor Felicia Sanders faced, you know, with interim pastor Norval Goff and then Betty Dees Clark. They both left her in a spiritual lurch. You can even look at the questionable, somewhat callous practices involving the millions of dollars in donations sent to the church in that chapter, Money in the Temple. Was it the limelight burning too bright as a result of this tragedy that exposed a lot of these issues? Or, you know, it's definitely part of this story. Like we said, there are a lot of fractious relationships throughout that first year especially.
Yeah, I think, you know, come to think of it, is that, you know, if you throw this kind of boulder into the lives of regular people, their responses are really varied and interesting. I think every positive relationship is magnified a million times, and every hurtful word, negative act is magnified by a million times. So when Reverend Goff was here, the survivors really wanted for him to come to their homes and to minister to them. Reverend Goff said in a press conference once that essentially they needed to come to the church to receive that ministry. You know, that was a huge burden for the survivors to carry, mm-hmm. and they wound up leaving the church as a result of the neglect that they felt. And I remember standing outside the church with Felicia Sanders one day. She and Polly Shepherd, the other adult survivor in the room, mm-hmm. agreed to talk to me about what they experienced. And it was a big step for them because they hadn't spoken publicly about it. And they wanted to take a picture inside the church in the sanctuary. And it was, you know, weekday morning. The church wasn't in use. The sanctuary wasn't in use. Polly is a church trustee. Felicia had been there a whole life, as had generations of their family. So we arrive at the church, and the church won't let them in to take this picture because they didn't have an appointment. And I remember Felicia standing outside crying. It was 100,000 degrees, and she had on a dark suit, and she was crying on Calhoun Street. I've lost my son, and now I'm losing my church. And it was a moment where I really realized there was so much else going on, and her pain was just infinite. She wound up leaving the church, as I mentioned earlier. But those kinds of things I felt like were very important to include, to understand their journey, honestly. Reverend Clark, on the other hand, when she came to Emmanuel, she did reach out to the survivors and she did try to minister to the people who were hurting. She got caught up, I think, more in some church politics and some other issues that were a little bit different. But I definitely credit her for reaching out. And I know Felicia appreciated that in particular. Why the church leaders didn't go to their homes and talk with them, I don't know. Reverend Goff would never explain it to me. And I don't know. I don't know. But the reality is that the survivors left the church feeling very hurt and neglected. Their feelings were directed at the leadership of the church, not the members of the church. They love the people there, and their leaving didn't have to do with the average congregant. It had to do with feeling that the leadership had neglected them.
And again, talking about that bright public spotlight, we did see Clementa Pinckney's widow, Jennifer, you know, really thrust into it. She's not a public person, even though her husband was, you know, state senator and obviously a very public reverend. And you just tell us that really, you know, there's a sweet moment there talking about just how much pressure there is and the year anniversary is coming up. And then they just decide, you know, not to do all those public engagements, you know, seemingly re-traumatizing her and her two daughters over and over again. They just go to the gravesite and have very personal moments. She seems like one of a very incredibly strong person.
She really is. And I think as a mother, I really connected with her desire to keep her children's lives as normal as possible when everything around them was in upheaval. You know, she told me that story, and I just thought that was so sweet, and that their daughter, their older daughter, Eliana, was honest about not wanting to go to all of the events and just wanting it to be them. I thought that spoke a lot to Jennifer's parenting and her ability to protect them from a lot of what was going on around South Carolina. You know, one thing that really interested me about her was that when she went back to her, she's a librarian, when she went back to school in the fall, this shooting occurred in June, so school was out. When she returned to her school in the fall, a lot of teachers there had no idea that her husband was a state senator and no idea his prominence. I thought it was really neat that they didn't know that, because I thought that spoke to her wanting to be her own person and wanting to be a librarian at that school, not a senator's wife, not a pastor's wife. I just really felt like that said something about who she was, and it spoke to how she handled things afterward. Mm-hmm. She's done a lot more public speaking lately, but it was not her comfort zone at all. And the same was true with Felicia and Polly, and particularly Felicia really did not like public speaking. It made her very nervous. Her son Tawanza, somewhat like Clemente Pinckney, was just a person who enjoyed being out in public, enjoyed and felt comfortable in that role, whereas they weren't. And I think they both grappled with this idea of, well, then why was I left here? You know, why was I left here to carry on this message? I don't have that skill. I wasn't, you know, God didn't give me that ability to feel comfortable in front of large groups. And yet they worked very hard to be able to do so, to spread the messages, you know, of love and forgiveness and faith and all that kind of thing that they felt was really important afterward.
Mm-hmm. And just kind of wrapping up here too, Jennifer, you know, we looked at the federal trial of Dylann Roof. That was a good portion of your book too. And we start to see somewhat more of a portrait emerge of this shooter. I know there are earlier accounts and we get some idea and descriptions, but we really get behind the scenes of the trial, particularly when he interacts with his mother and father. And you kind of see how, you know, this family is also torn apart and they're racked with shame, guilt, and simply confusion. Talk with me a little bit about what it was like working with that part of the book, and then also the trial and just how intense of a time that was.
Before the trial, the survivors and the family members, when I asked them the question of, do you think this is more about gun violence or do you think this is more about racism, they would almost always say gun violence. But after the trial, when I asked that question of several of them, they almost all said racism. And I think that's because during the trial, we heard so much of his writings. You know, we watched his confession, which was very lengthy. The video of that was very lengthy. We heard things that he wrote after the shooting about how he had not shed a tear for the innocent people he killed. Mm-hmm. So that I think enduring all of that sort of changed the way a lot of us thought about it. It was absolutely grueling. You know, it went over several weeks. And, you know, we all saw the crime scene photos, which is something I guarantee you nobody who saw this will ever forget. I remember, I think for me, one of the most difficult parts of this whole thing was sitting in court at the very end. Nathan Williams, one of the prosecutors, was giving a closing and he showed the crime scene photos. And then he juxtaposed over their bodies a picture of their living self, smiling and very much alive. For me, that was absolutely just so difficult to process because you're looking at this very living person. The only one of these people, or the only two of the victims that I knew before this were Reverend Pinckney, who I knew only superficially, and Cynthia Hurd, who I'd worked with at the library, but only briefly, and not, I didn't know her well. So I only knew these people as memories, but to see their living self juxtaposed over their body was for me just devastating. And that was the moment, I think, where just the weight of the tremendous loss was most pronounced. And it's interesting that it would come during the trial, but it was long and grueling. I can't really describe the exhaustion that I went home with every night.
Mm-hmm. And just really quickly, Jennifer, can you share with us an excerpt from your book and just give a little bit of background about where it is and the context for it?
Sure, sure. And you know, I thought this might be a useful one to read because you mentioned Nikki Haley earlier. You know, before the shooting, I thought that then-Governor Haley often came across as sort of practiced and a little bit plastic, honestly. But when this occurred, I really saw her much more as a human being, and I got to know her more. And interestingly, she and Felicia Sanders, the survivor, have maintained a close friendship since then. And so knowing that now, I thought this was an interesting excerpt to read because it's the beginning of that relationship. In this excerpt, Felicia, who played dead with her little granddaughter as Roof shot and killed her son Tawanza, is struggling with that lack of ministry from Emanuel's leaders. And then out of the blue, Felicia and her husband Tyrone receive a call from Haley. So that's where we pick up here. Felicia continued to yearn to hear from her church leaders, although none came to her home. While she waited, Governor Haley called instead with a surprising request. Can I come see you? Haley needed to meet Felicia. She needed to talk to her in person and let her know how sorry she was for all that she'd endured. So much well-placed attention had gone to those killed that she worried about those who had lived. It was selfish on some level, Haley knew, but she simply needed to know that Felicia was okay. She also wanted to meet the woman who'd forgiven the racist killer. Haley, a Christian herself, wondered, could I do that? Felicia invited her over. A few days later, Haley rode in a plain black SUV with two staffers and her security detail. They turned down a long two-lane residential street, passing house after house, including one with a Confederate flag hanging on its porch. Then they turned down the Sanders long driveway, nestled by two big live oak trees. Haley emerged from the SUV into the humid summer air, partly as the state's governor, partly as a mother herself, mostly as someone worried about the woman inside the house who had survived something so unimaginable. She walked to the front steps and climbed onto a long front porch with a white rail. Felicia and Tyrone emerged from the front door. Haley had attended Tawanza's funeral. She had seen Felicia and Tyrone there and later at the ceremony to lower the flag. However, they hadn't really met, not in a quiet way like this one. Felicia led her into a living room just inside the front door, toward a couch, two chairs, and photos of Tawanza. She asked Haley to please choose a seat. The governor sat down facing Felicia. Tyrone joined them. Yet beyond their overt graciousness, Haley felt a wall of suspicion, as if the couple wondered, why was the governor here? Was she hoping to gain something from them? Haley presented Felicia with a crisply folded American flag that had flown in honor of Tawanza above the statehouse, along with one of the 9 pens she used to sign the bill lowering the Confederate flag. They began to relax a little. Felicia described how she couldn't even hear gunshots on a TV show anymore, not without reliving those horrific moments. Where Felicia seemed so sad and broken, Tyrone came across as edgy and hard. For a moment, the governor pondered two such different responses to grief. Then she asked them to tell her more about Tawanza. Felicia smiled widely. She described her son's poetry, his jokes, his books, his dreams. Tyrone, a wiry bald man with a commanding voice, admitted that he couldn't stop listening to a Lion King song that reminded him of his baby boy. Tawanza was his Simba. They spoke about their granddaughter, the huggy little girl who survived the shooting, and how hard they were trying to keep her life as normal as possible. Theirs was a house that had welcomed so many children over the years, their own, family members, friends, others. Felicia wanted to love and rescue them all, but she hadn't been able to save her own son. When she cried, Haley handed her a tissue. When the governor cried, Felicia handed her one. "Tell me how to help you," Haley finally said. Felicia looked back with the saddest eyes Haley had ever seen. Felicia's answer had nothing to do with politics, not gun control or race relations or any of the things Haley typically heard. Instead, Felicia explained that they desperately needed spiritual guidance. They needed to know why their son had died in front of her, in a church, in their church, trying to protect them all. They needed to know God's intentions in this tragedy. They spoke for more than an hour before Haley felt it was time to go. She didn't want to overstay her welcome. They said goodbyes and she stepped back onto the front porch. Haley had almost reached her SUV, her security detail still waiting in the driveway, when she heard Felicia's voice behind her from the front porch. "I got to tell him I loved him," she called. "And he told me he loved me too."
Powerful moment in that story, one of many. Jennifer Barry Hawes is the author of the new book, Grace Will Lead Us Home, The Charleston Massacre and the Hard, Inspiring Journey to Forgiveness. Jennifer, thank you for your steadfastness and dedication to this work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Gavin. It's always great to talk with you.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on SCETV.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV, Fridays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and SouthCarolinaPublicRadio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts, search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Also, be sure to rate and review us on iTunes. Follow us on Instagram at SCLeadPod, and you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our dank memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at SCLEDEPOD. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scled@scetv.org. South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Tom Posey is our executive producer. Sean Scott is our intern. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on Thursday, May 30th, 2019. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. AT has a locker full of Pop-Tarts. Toaster strudel rules.
Bring us to the pool.